we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
There's something about a crisis, a health scare, a near-death experience that makes you really think about your life and how you're living it. Lots of people report this sort of thing.
And David Robertson actually has had an experience with it. He's a church minister in Scotland, an historian and prolific debater. He's taken on the likes of Richard Dawkins in his books. And he's had a near-death experience, literally. He found himself one day in a pool of his own blood at death's door. And he returned to the edge of death at several times throughout his recovery.
Yeah, this is a pretty amazing story, Justine.
Yeah, it's a pretty incredible story, and it actually gets a lot worse before it gets better. Now, David was in Sydney recently, and he came in to tell us about his experience.
Well, I was doing a wedding, and I began to get a cold sweat, which was really quite unusual. And afterwards, I said to my wife, look, just drive me home. Let's not go to the reception. But we had to go back to the church to collect my son's iPhone, which was quite funny because the newspaper ran a story about iPhone saves minister's life. You know? And when I got out of the car, I said, I don't think I'm feeling too good. And I stood up, and then the next thing I knew, I was lying in a pool of blood and so on. Thankfully, it was just outside a doctor's surgery, so that was very helpful. They sent me to hospital. It was the Heliobacter virus, which creates ulcers. Not normally a major problem, except I had two that were over a major artery and they had burst the artery. And as a result, I was gushing blood. So apparently I needed, I think it was 28 pints of blood product, given your body's only got 8. And then my body didn't cope with that and my lungs collapsed and I ended up being in ICU. I ended up being in there for about 11 weeks, in and out of a coma. I got E. coli of the lung. I got pneumonia. I got, you name it, I got it.
So it's like just goes from bad to worse.
Yeah. They couldn't. Yeah, wow. I mean, each week and my wife would have a meeting with them and they would say, it's 50-50 whether he'll live. Even if he does live, he'll be a vegetable. I had a hemoglobin count of 4, which means the oxygen wasn't getting to my brain.
Gosh. What was it like for your family? I mean, you've said already that it would have been really hard for your wife, but your son also posted something on Facebook that was wrestling with the reality of perhaps losing his father.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary what happened. Of course, I only read it when I got home months later, but I still think this is probably the strongest example of faith that I've ever come across. Now, remember, this is a young man, early 20s. He's still a student. And he wrote on his Facebook page, I've just been to see my dad with my sister, probably for the last time. We're praying that he would be healed, but in one sense, our prayers have already been answered. My dad's biggest problem is not his illness, but his sin, and that's already been dealt with. So whether my dad dies or my dad lives, we know that our prayers will be answered. Now, I think that's an easy thing to write in a theology exam. I think it's virtually impossible to write when you're coming back from what you perceive to be the deathbed of your father. I can't read that without being very emotional about it, you know, because I just thought, I think, where did that come from? You know, it's the difference between a faith that is just merely saying a creed or going along with a group and having something that at the very deepest in your own life guide your life, really, and strengthens you and affects you. It really was quite extraordinary. And my wife as well, one time she asked, can I pray with you? And I was in a really bad way, in lots of ways. And I said, well, what can you pray? Apparently, she told me this. And I said that I'd been in hell. And she said, no, Jesus. And then she realized what she was saying to me was just cliche at one level. And so what they ended up doing is every time they would come in, they would sit down and they would read one of the Psalms in the Bible. And the nurses were just utterly amazed at this because they'd never seen anything like this. It wasn't like their last rites or something. It was just because they're so emotional. The Psalms are so emotional. And they express what they felt and they express what I felt. So I think for them it was a really hard experience.
But also a really traumatic experience for you as well. I mean, you mentioned it, that there was a spiritual blackness that you were in, that you were in hell.
Yeah. I don't talk about it, and I don't go into details because it's funny how things get triggered. I had some pretty dark experiences, and it was interesting. Afterwards, the hospital psychologist came to see me before I was due to get out, and she said, "You're going to struggle to recover from this." And she said, "It'll take you about 2 years." And I said, "Oh, no, no. My surgeon said I'll be up and walking within 6 months," because by then my muscles had entropied. I couldn't walk. I'd had a DVT. You name it. And she said, no, I'm talking psychologically. And I said, okay. So I like reading The Spectator magazine. Last week, I tried to read a page of it. Normally takes me 5 minutes, took me an hour. She said, yeah, that's the kind of psychological effect. I said, yeah, but hang on a minute. Today I read a book. She says, what kind of book? I said, it's a book on philosophy by Oz Guinness. 220 pages. Do you want to talk about it? And she said, no, you're a freak. And she and I talked a lot. And she said, you know, your mind is what saved you and almost killed you, because your mind, you're so determined to live. But also it was virtually impossible to sedate you. We had to completely knock you out because you wouldn't let us sedate you. And I kept ripping things out and so on, which is very distressing again for my family. But I went back to see her and we talked a bit and I said, I want to ask you something. I said, I had some experiences which I find difficult to explain. And I said, I would regard them as spiritual experiences, but I'd like your opinion as a psychiatrist. And I said, please don't, you know, give me the answer you think I want to hear. I said, I can take whatever you're going to say to me. I'm just genuinely interested in your opinion. So I described a little bit of the experiences, and I said, to me, they were a manifestation of evil, and they were spiritual. And she looked at me and she said, I'm not a believer. I'm not a Christian. But I think your analysis is as good as any. She says, I can't explain that in a psychological way.
You've mentioned that it was a really dark time in some ways for you, mm-hmm. but I'm also conscious that there were some incredible experiences as well. So there was a man apparently who prayed for you, having woken up at 3 a.m. and could not go back to sleep until he'd done that. And that was an experience that was shared by others as well.
This is a really weird thing. And again, you know, when I talk with my non-Christian friends, it's a hard thing to explain. My church is a very traditional, conservative church, and this doesn't normally happen, but at one point, the moderator of our church, I think is what we would call him, or the clerk of the assembly, wrote every single church in the denomination and said, whatever you're doing at 12 o'clock on Sunday, stop and pray for David. And that was a Sunday in November. That Friday, I got pneumonia and almost died on the Saturday morning. They pumped liquid out me for 18 hours. And it's a hard thing to explain, but from that point on, I got better. Now, I want to be very careful about this, because I had a colleague who's a minister who was ill at the same time, who had cancer and was expected to get better. I was expected to die. I lived, but he died. So it's not like I'm saying, well, look, if you just have enough prayer, everyone gets better. Obviously, that doesn't happen, and I'm going to die. And, you know, in the Bible, Lazarus, he was raised from the dead, but he was going to die again. So I think my son's attitude is a more healthy one, the one I mentioned earlier. But it still nonetheless was extraordinary. So there were Malaysian Baptists waking up at 3 a.m. I mean, so many other people have written to me and said, we had a phenomenal burden. And actually, I have to have, this is my favorite one. I got so many cards, like real cards that people write with pens.
Physical
and
cards, wow. Yeah, you know, imagine that.
Do you remember those, Justine? Yeah. You're too young. And the one, my absolute favorite, was from two atheists. Because by the way, everyone loves you when you're dying. So I used to get all this, I knew I was getting better when I started getting the hate mail again. Yeah. Everyone loves you when you're dying. And these two atheists who'd wrote me and they said, Dear David, you know, we're really sorry what's happened to you. We're praying for you. And that's one of the cards I couldn't resist replying to. I just wrote back, thanks, to whom?
Did you get a reply?
No. I think by then they'd figured I was recovered.
In the midst of this experience, you even heard what you feel was a word from God, this kind of assurance that this wasn't your time. For whatever reason, this wasn't your time. You still had work to do. Now, you were on some pretty strong drugs at the time, and you were watching Lord of the Rings, right? And delusional. Well,
they took the Lord of the Rings away from me very,
right,
very
okay.
early.
But so why? How is this experience not a delusion? What convicts you of its reality?
Okay, I'll tell you what delusional is, because I wrote lots of things which I kept, and they're quite hard to read. I also went back to the ICU and apologized for some of the things I said. You know, like I was, thought I was on a ship. I always had grandiose visions. I thought Gaddafi was after me. I at one time accused the nurses of being Real Madrid supporters and having...
That's the worst, right?
Yeah, well, I was, I'm a Barcelona fan, and I wrote it because I couldn't speak. I wrote, they threw me out of the ward last night because they were watching the game. Now, remember, I'm lying there with tubes everywhere. My muscles have atrophied. I can't move. And I said, no, she said, there's no television here. I said, honestly, they threw me out. And so on. And I said, did all of that. And she actually wrote, David, 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 can you possibly consider you might be wrong? And it shows you my character in a bad way, that I actually wrote, Annabelle, 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 can you possibly consider I might be right? You know? So even on death's door, I was still arguing. So when I went back, they said, no, David, you are on very, very strong drugs, which do have very strong delusional side effects. However, the point you're describing, I was out of the ICU in the high dependency unit, and I was off the drugs. I was very lucid because I remember this. I remember being mad at the man opposite me because I was on nil by mouth, and I was just dying for stuff. And he had baskets of fruit and everything, and he wasn't even eating them. And then I remember lying there one night, and because I couldn't move and I couldn't read and I couldn't watch anything and I couldn't sleep and the pain was still quite strong, I remember I'd been preaching through the book of Ephesians in the Bible, and I remember just repeating it to myself. And then suddenly this realization, now it wasn't a voice, I don't know how to describe it. And it wasn't just an intuition, and it wasn't a dream, because I was awake. I know I was awake. But I suddenly realized how ill I'd been. I hadn't realized till then that I'd been dying. And I suddenly thought, it's as though I came to my senses and thought, wait a minute, why are you here with all these tubes? You've been in hospital for weeks. You must have been dying. There must be something seriously wrong. You must be in big trouble. And then I don't even know how to describe it. Not an audible voice, but an absolute impression that went something along these lines. You are going to get out of here. Whether it's for 5 months, 5 years, or 50 years is none of your business. It's mine. But what you are going to do is teach my word. And I believe that was from God. I also believe that I was told, this is a real test of whether your church is my church or yours. You know, because... my congregation, St. Peter's in Dundee, had been growing and really had a big growth spurt just before I went into hospital. Thankfully, when I came out and went back, it was lovely because it had continued to grow, so much so that I was sitting there in a wheelchair a couple of months later, and I said to the two young ladies who were there, oh, are you visitors? And they said, no, this is our church. Are you a visitor? And I said, no, I'm actually the minister. Oh, you're the guy we've been praying for. So, yeah, I mean, you can explain that in lots of different ways. I don't think you can explain it as delusional. You could explain it as wishful thinking if you want, but I think there are too many coincidences in all of that.
In light of the fact that you hadn't been significantly ill before this incident, what do you make of that? It's just come out of the blue. You're deathly ill. You're close to death. Does it change who you thought you were or who you are?
It changed everything. There is a teaching in the Bible about life being but a breath. For me, that became literal. My problem was I couldn't breathe. I was put in an incubator. They tried a fishbowl over my head. My big problem was my lungs went down to 30% capacity. I couldn't breathe. So life is but a breath. When I came out of, I remember the day I came out of hospital, I was allowed home for 2 hours. I argued with my surgeon all the time. And he said, David, I can't let you home. Why should I let you home? And I said, I need fresh air and I need some rest. And I need to stay free of germs. And he looked at me and he said, you're a clever so-and-so. Because those are the only reasons that count. He said, for that reason, I'll let you out for 2 hours just to see how you get on. So I went out and I breathed the air. And I remember thinking, I'm just a breath. You know, so the fragility of life. I was fragile before. I mean, it's an illusion. The illusion is that we're strong and we're going to live forever. The reality is we're just a breath. And that lovely little baby, I've just had a grandson, and, you know, I'm as fragile as he is in a different way, but it's still there. I could collapse and go, you know. And I think I knew that in theory, but knowing it in practice. So I argue with my surgeon to get out of hospital. He agrees to let me out for 2 hours. My wife comes with a special taxi and stuff and take me in the wheelchair, get me in it, take me back home, get me in sitting down in a study that my daughter had insisted we redo when my wife was saying, well, what's the point? Let's see if Dad's going to live first. I said, no, he's going to live. We're going to do it. And they did. They did a lot of work. So I went and sat in there. I'm thinking, where's my family? I come home and they don't even come to see me because they were all outside. I was hearing these shouts of delight and so on. As we arrived and got in, this van drew up and there was this hamper came out, this big Marks and Spencer's hamper with all kinds of goodies in it, you know, everything from malt whiskey to cheese. It was just wonderful. And here's the thing. It was sent by somebody in the United States ages before. I'm not even sure they knew I was in hospital. It was just a thank you for something. And it arrived within a couple of minutes of me getting home. And then 2 minutes later, a whole bunch of flowers arrived. And again, now, what do you do with that? Me, I see it as tokens from a heavenly father. I really do. And my family do as well. It was just a stunning, inverted commas, coincidence. How do people explain those kind of things? You know, to me, it's stunning. So for me, life is but a breath, but also life is filled with glorious things as well as the ugly.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Something that struck me about David's story is that he's comfortable and really emphatic about being grateful to both God and medicine. So he's got faith in Jesus and science, and he believes that both saved his life.
Well, I think God uses means. And I think you do get some extreme religious people who say, don't go near a doctor because you just got to trust God. That's just crazy. That's like me saying, I'm really, really hungry just now, so I'm going to sit at this table and wait for ravens to fly in with food. You know, no, I'm going to have to go out and get some food. But I think that God provides it. Those two things are not contrary. And I think, it's interesting because when I did recover and they decided to hold a Thanksgiving service in the church, I phoned up my surgeon's wife, actually, and he's a Muslim, wonderful man called Mr. Shimi. And I said to her, I'd like to invite Mr. Shimi, because I still had to call him that as a surgeon. I'd like to invite him and you to the Thanksgiving service. She said, we'd love to come. And I said, oh, you made my day. That's so good. And she said, why? I said, your husband saved my life. She said, no, that's not what he says. I said, okay, what does he say? He says that God saved your life. He says that there's only two people in his whole career, and he's been a surgeon for over 30 years, that he regards as a miracle, and you're one of them. And he quite happily tells people that. And I said, well, do you know this? It's not often I get my theology corrected by a Muslim, but yes, you're right.
That's cute.
Correct.
What's your sense of how this experience impacted on the lives of others? I mean, you're sitting in, you know, you're going through this horrible experience. Your family is there. You're having some really dark times as well in the midst of all of this. But there are support staff. There's Mr. Shimi. How are they thinking of what's happening to you and how are they making sense of it?
Well, who knows? I mean, Mr. Shimi doesn't understand why I'm still alive. He said that. He said that he can only attribute it to divine. I mean, he's a brilliant surgeon. But I mean, it was just the hemoglobin count. I mean, I think he understands why I'm still alive, just why I'm not, you know, in a vegetative state or something. Other staff, it's fascinating. There was one nurse when I began to get better because my muscles had atrophied. I couldn't shower. And it's funny, you don't think about this. I had no qualms problems about being bathed by a female nurse completely naked. And there was one nurse who seemed to want to do it a lot. And I began to think, this is a bit weird. Why does she always want to bathe me, you know? And I'm glad this is radio because I'm not particularly good looking. So I don't think there was any other motivation in there. And then I realized what she was doing. When we're in the shower room, it took about 15 minutes. And that was time we had together. And she would always ask me, David, how do you read the Bible? David, how do you pray? I mean, there was another time a doctor came in I hadn't seen before. And he asked the ward doctor, you carry on in the wards, close the door. I was in a room on my own. And I thought, oh dear, he's going to tell me something. Not again. You know, I'd had so many relapses. And he said, I need to ask you something. And I thought, okay, go ahead, you know, whatever. And he said, I've been a doctor here for a number of years. I mean, I won't identify him at all, but he said, what's the point of life, David? And we just sat and talked. And I just realized that, you know, I'd been given so much that, again, Mr. Shimmy, before I left, it was, again, so funny. One of the older nurses said, one of the doctors actually said, you're very lucky to be getting out of here. And one of the nurses said, no, he's not lucky. He said, we prayed. And I thought, good for you. But then Mr. Shimmy sat with me and he said, David, you have got one of the greatest gifts now ever given to somebody in your position. And I said, what's that? He said, you teach and speak about the most important things known to humanity. And now you've experienced them. He said, almost nobody will come as close to death as you have. Now, it's interesting because I didn't see visions and I didn't, a BBC journalist did an interview with me once and she asked, did you get to the gates of heaven and St. Peter turn you back or did you get a tour and told heaven's not ready for you yet and all that kind of, and I said, no, nothing like that. And she said, that's a shame because you'd have a number one bestseller book on the New York Times, best-selling list. And she said, did your theology change? And I said, no, my theology didn't change because I'd always believed in heaven and hell and God and Jesus. And I still do now. I said, nothing theological changed, but something did. And she said, what was that? And I said, well, I think I believed it in my head, but now I feel it. And I said, I tell you what it's like. It's like I know that water is really important and fresh air. But see, when I came out of hospital for the first time, breathing that cold December Scottish air was like manna. It was just beautiful. And drinking water was just... And I said, and in the same way, that sense of the spiritual, the sense of the reality of God and heaven and the Bible and Jesus and so on, I said, it's much more real. I personally would rather not go through that experience again. I mean, I'm still not going to commend it as an experience. I wouldn't want anyone to go through it. But in some ways, the fruit of it has been quite remarkable.
One of the times that you shared this personal story was at a conference on faith and science. And you shared it to rebut a scientist who had said he'd never met anyone who was healed through prayer. So how did he respond to your story once you got up and, once you tore up your prepared talk and gave this talk instead?
Well, it was quite strange because it was the British Council who'd arranged this conference in the far, far north of Scotland. It was the first thing I'd spoke at since I recovered. And their idea of religion was apparently two Muslims and me in Britain, which was interesting. And then their idea of non-religion was scientists. Now, I know plenty of scientists who are Christians, so I didn't like the dichotomy. So I had this talk prepared on science and faith. And the scientist stood up and said, at the end of the day, the reason I don't believe is I've never met anyone who's been healed in answer to prayer. And I just thought, how can I resist this? So I stood up and ripped up my talk and said, you're going to forget this. I said, because now you have. And I told him my story. And in particular, I told him about my son's statement about prayer. I was also, by the way, the really difficult part of this is that the widow of my colleague who died was there as well. So, she was there, which was incredibly brave of her. She had, young children and everything. And I told them all what my son had said, and the scientist said, but that's not fair. If you die, it's an answer to prayer, and if you don't die, it's an answer. He said, that means God wins every time. And I started laughing. I said, thank you. You just give me the title of my next book. I said, of course. I said, that is the point. You know, we're not selling religion to you like some magic formula that makes you healthy and wealthy. And I explained that. And afterwards, I was actually much more moved by the widow coming up to me afterwards and just saying thank you for saying that. You know, because it wasn't because I was more righteous or anything than him, or people prayed more, or, you know, or I had a greater work to do. It's just the real faith is to trust God in the good and the bad.
While part of his job is to defend the Christian faith, which means he debates a lot of atheists and agnostics, David really gets them. In fact, he wanted to be an atheist really badly when he was younger, but he just couldn't make sense of it for himself.
I have an enormous amount of sympathy. I'd want to know why people are atheists. I think some of the more angry militant atheists, which are only a tiny percentage, are that because of bad religious experiences, often, not always, but often. But an awful lot of other people are atheists, or nowadays they're much more likely to say agnostic because they haven't seen the evidence and so on. So I've got a great deal of sympathy with that. And I have a great deal of sympathy with some of the arguments.
So what kinds of arguments then?
Strangely enough, not the suffering one, because I think atheists still have a, you know, you take God out of the equation, they're still suffering. But the bigger ones I have are something that you guys have done, and I believe you just released a film on, the history of the church and Christianity. There are some aspects in that that make you go, what? You're kidding me. There are some difficult questions that arise out of the Bible. I used to have, I would say, about 100 plus. I think I'm down to about 6 left. But, so I have a lot of sympathy with that. I think the whole question of why things are the way they are, if God is good, is another one. So where I'm struggling with most atheists is I think their solutions to these problems are at best weak, very, very, very weak. And the more I go on, the more I see what I would call biblical Christianity. I think there's an awful lot of Christianity which I struggle with. But I think the biblical answers to why humans are the way that we are and the world is the way that it is, and the solution that's offered, I've not come across anything like it. So it strengthened me in that.
I know you said that the suffering question doesn't loom as large for you, but given that you had this tremendous experience of suffering, surely that has more purchase on you now because you've actually gone through it.
Well, yeah, except it's more likely to make me believe in God. I mean, here's the interesting thing. I find, as somebody who does a lot of debating with atheists, the people who get most wound up about suffering tend to be people, dare I say this, they tend to be middle-class liberals who are in nice, well-off jobs and lovely homes and haven't experienced much suffering themselves, and they use suffering. What I find is this. I find that many people who've gone through suffering, it's driven them to God. Now, some people it drives away. So if they've been brought up with a religion that says, if you're really nice, God will help you pass your exams, your cat won't die and your granny will live forever. Well, when your cat dies and your granny doesn't live forever and you fail your exams, you go, I don't believe in that God. Well, that's because he never existed. And the God you believed in just didn't exist. But I remember one situation where there was a couple who didn't come to my church. But I knew them quite well. They liked me. They hated the church. They hated Christianity. And I understood that. And they had an 18-month-old baby daughter who died, a cot death. And I was, oh, no. And then they asked me to take the funeral. And you don't, it's funerals you don't want to take, the wee 3-foot coffin, just private family service. And next Sunday morning, I stand up to preach, and the mother is in church. Now, they're never in church. Totally against it. And I was shocked. And so coming out the door, I said to her, excuse me, I need to ask you, what are you doing here? I said, you're very welcome, but this is a lie. I mean, if you hated God before. And she just looked at me and she said, David, if there's no God, none of this makes any sense.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart, and Justine Toe.
If you want to hear more conversations on life and faith, go to our website, publicchristianity.org, and check out our podcast. Just type Life and Faith in the search box of your podcast app to find us.
Next week.
A lot of people have an opinion on the Bible, whether that comes from a place of faith or from somewhere quite different to that. And that's been true historically too. It's always been gloves off when it comes to the Bible in Australia. In a way, it was an entree to the great debates in Australian society and culture and history. What kind of society are the colonists building? What kind of critiques will Indigenous Australians offer white society? All those things open right up once I put the story of the Bible and the ways Australians have argued over it, made sense of it, you know, rejected it at the centre of the story. I found it, I was hooked.